Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Before $10 Hollywood movies, before email and internet and Twitter sliced our narratives into bits and bytes, we can all remember when someone just told us an amazing story. On the porch, in the backyard, on a bus. My guest today says we need to get back to the tradition of personal storytelling. The most remarkable stories, he says, are heard and told right at the kitchen table, anywhere people are just sitting, ready to talk. This hour On Point novelist George Dawes Green, founder of the Moth Storytelling Club, on the transfixing, transformative power of storytelling. Joining me now from Savannah, Georgia's George Dawes Green, prize-winning novelist and founder of The Moth, a popular nonprofit storytelling organization that features live performances of true personal stories. The Moth now gathers storytellers in New York and around the world, and on the Moth Radio Hour, which aired last year on over 200 public radio stations. Green is author of The Caveman's Valentine, The Juror, and his latest novel, Ravens, just out in paperback. Stephen King called it one of the 10 best books of 2009. George Dawes Green, welcome to On Point.
It's good to be here. How are you, Tom?
I'm just fantastic, and it's nice to have you there in Savannah. Love Savannah. And love storytelling, and you have become like a major league proponent thereof. Did you set out to become an evangelist for storytelling, George?
No, I started The Moth in New York because I got bored of cocktail parties where you're interrupted every 12 seconds because egos and testosterones are flying everywhere, and nobody will give anybody any space to expand, and I knew that New York was filled with great raconteurs, but because you can hear stories, you know, when you're one-on-one or in tiny little dinner parties. But I wanted to give people a chance to expand, so I thought, well, what if I have an evening where people are allowed to go on for, you know, 10 or 12 minutes or 15 minutes and tell their stories? And we found that, you know, from the very first evening, there was this tremendous hunger for people to listen to these stories. And so it wasn't that the raconteurs weren't there. It's just that I think partly because of this, you know, this hyper culture that we live in, nobody was given room to talk.
We know people love stories. They've always loved stories and for a long time have celebrated great storytellers. Why? You've thought about human nature and stories. Why is storytelling important to us as a species?
Oh, this is actually really fascinating. Why? I mean, I really think that I think that we evolved the ability to tell and listen to stories because stories are a great way to impart bundles of information because they're very complex. Narratives and clusters of information that are held together by emotion. And so I really think that storytelling is one of the things that defines the human primate and seems to separate us from other primates. And as we evolved, we just got better and better at storytelling to the point we're really surrounded by stories all the time now. You know, from the average kid will hear stories when he's in class. He comes home and turns on the TV and watches hours of stories. He goes on the internet. He might, you might go on the news. And if you go on the news, you don't really want to hear a bunch of undigested facts. You want to hear the story of Sarah Palin and her, you know, and her crazy daughter and whatever, you know. But you want the story.
So if that's the case, if we're surrounded by stories and we have more media these days that can bring them to us in more ways than ever, then what's the importance of the, I don't know, the front porch story, the campfire story, the just riding on the bus and sharing story? What's the importance of that, your moth kind of story?
Well, I think what happened is along the way, we have to celebrate stories, but along the way, we forgot about the necessity of some sense of community. and of really hearing stories from another person who's right there in front of you, and the gesture, you know, the physical gesture. You know, this is another interesting thing, because the development of speech. We evolved speech out of our motor circuits, which is why when we speak, you still see that we kind of gesture uncontrollably.
Those hands move, that face moves, the whole body may move.
Exactly. And also songbirds, who are the only other speakers, they also evolved entirely separately, but they evolved their ability to sing out of their motor circuitry, which is why only primates and songbirds really dance. And there's something about this sort of dancing, gesturing, storytelling performance that we put on that is entirely lost when it gets filtered through the internet or through movies or TV. And just that idea of being able to sit and listen to a whole story is it's such a beautiful experience. And yet this is the interesting thing. We were talking about, you were saying, well, this is a very old art form. It is an old art form, but it was never really celebrated as an art form.
It's storytelling.
Storytelling was always kept in the kitchen or on the porch. So when Homer would stand up and deliver his stories, those were always very formal, memorized stories. And the spontaneous, unrehearsed, personal stories he would, have to tell in the kitchen. And that went on for millennia, and it wasn't really until The Moth that we brought those kitchen stories out in front of audiences. And audiences immediately responded. And that's why, The Moth now has been running for about 14 years. We have never not sold out. We've had thousands of performances. We have a performance every week in New York, every couple of weeks in Chicago and L.A. and Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and Perth, Australia. But wherever we go, the lines go around the block because people are really, really hungry for this elemental art form.
We've got a little tape of some segments, at least, of some of those stories shared at The Moth. We'll play a bit of that in this hour. George Dawes Green is the founder of The Moth, novelist. His latest is Ravens, just out of paperback now. But here's a clip, George. You may know this one. This is the playwright Edgar Oliver talking about his eccentric upbringing in your terrain there, Savannah, Georgia. This was recorded at the Moth main stage in New York in January.
Let me just introduce by saying that this is Edgar's natural voice.
Okay.
This isn't a performance. This is the voice that he's had since he was a little kid.
Here it is, the real Edgar Oliver.
Mother used to always say to us, Savannah is a trap. It'll try to imprison you. Even if you manage to get away, it'll find a way to drag you back. Mother also used to say, beware of other people. They won't understand you. We're different. We're artists. So all throughout my childhood, it was just the three of us, Mother, Helen, and me. And then there was the world, as though we were lost in it. We were like three lost children, Mother, Helen, and me.
Playwright Edgar Oliver talking about growing up in Savannah there. Wow, that's his real voice. Blanche DuBois got nothing on him, George.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful voice. And he speaks of his sister. His sister has a very similar voice. And to hear them, the two of them together is an amazing experience.
Is that a genuine Savannah article, a genuine Savannah manner of speech?
Well, not exactly. Edgar was raised by his mama and sort of kept isolated from other children in the neighborhood. And she'd pick the kids up from school and they'd just drive around for hours and hours in this old Chevy 2 that she had.
With her telling him, we are artists. Different
exactly.
Artists.
We're artists. And then they'd go home at night and they could watch TV, and they tended to watch horror movies that came on late at night.
Oh, so boy. Okay.
There's no telling exactly.
Little Bela Lugosi is somewhere in there.
I don't know exactly where he got that voice, but as you can hear, it's a tremendously resonant instrument, but it's also a part of Edgar's genius. And when you're at the Moth and Edgar ensorcels you into one of his tales, you're a few minutes into it and you're absolutely carried out of the world into an entirely other world.
In sorcels, as in sorceries?
In sorcery. Okay. Yeah, when he puts a spell on
yeah.
you.
We hear it right there. George Dawes Green, there's a lot more we want to go to with you on this storytelling front. We're so glad you're with us today from Savannah, Georgia. Novelist George Dawes Green is here. Novelist, his latest is Ravens. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. George Dawes Green joins us from Savannah, Georgia. We've got some tape from The Moth. Here's a little bit from 2007. This was part of the Penn World Voices Festival. Novelist Jonathan Ames, creator of the HBO series Bored to Death, performing at an evening with The Moth. In this clip, he tells how his mother once handed him a surprising letter.
I open up the envelope, and I begin to read the letter, and it begins, "Dear Jonathan, prepare yourself for a shock." And then I see the words, "your son." And then I see the words, 15-month-old baby boy. And then I'm like, this is quite a shock. And I open up the envelope a little bit more, and I see that there's a photograph. And it's a photograph of a 15-month-old baby boy with beautiful blue eyes and bright red hair. And I mentioned the bright red hair because at the time, I myself had a full head of bright red hair, all of which forcibly ejected from my skull in that moment. It was sort of like, you know, Jonestown in Guyana. Just everybody just left, died, like everyone in Edgar's story. It was just death. And I knew that I was looking at my son. And I put my son back in the envelope, and then I hid him in a dictionary. I was attending to my books. And my mother said, "Who wrote?" I'm Jewish, which means there's no boundaries, so everything is just... And I said, "The mother of your illegitimate non-Jewish grandchild."
That's all. Novelist Jonathan Ames there. George, we've got so many people calling and writing in here. Nora says, "Story." This is on the website. Nora, story is amazing on so many levels. It's metacognition, the natural format of our thinking. And storytelling, she writes, is deeply satisfying entertainment because it engages us on so many levels. And here's Art saying, "Our neighborhood Monday night poker game fosters some pretty good stories." And caller Sylvia in Salt Lake City. Sylvia, you're on the air with George Dawes Green in Savannah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Sylvia.
What's your story? Hi, Sylvia?
Well, the question I heard was, where do you tell your stories?
Yeah.
And for my family, when we are traveling, we travel from Utah to California a couple of times a year, and when we get my husband and myself and all the kids in the van or the truck, that's when storytelling happens. Stories from my childhood, from my husband's childhood. I tell them stories from my grandpa's childhood, story of when he was saved from a bear by his dog. And, you know, those are fascinating for my kids. And then invariably my husband starts making up stories, and he has this running story of two men on motorcycles traveling across the country, and he makes up all kinds of escapades.
That sounds like a great venue and a great format. How do you know when you're on a roll, Sylvia? Can you tell?
The kids they're all leaning forward, listening. You know, they're not poking each other and whining when are we going to be there. You know, they really get engaged. And what happened next, Daddy?
Right. That's great. Sylvia, thanks. George, what about venues, whether it's on the road to California or, you know, where do you find it happens and happens best?
Well, this is, you know, this is amazing because we like to say that the moth happens or the moth alights whenever people are telling stories. And we're getting a lot of response from people who say now that they're having dinner parties where they ask the question, if this were the moth, what story would you tell? And, you know, people have a little bit of time before the dinner party to get this set up, and people are loving these dinner parties. These evenings are magical in a way that, you know, people haven't experienced in a long time. But I just find particularly late at night, and particularly if you've got a little alcohol.
Libation, maybe.
Always helps. A little bit of bourbon or wine. And then stories come rolling out. We have at the Moth, we have one thing. We have a musician who will play a few notes, like a violin or...
Okay, just to set a mood, to set a tone, or what?
No, just a few notes if you start going on too long. And,
oh, okay.
You know, because that
the
is
gong.
A problem.
Right.
People often don't realize that they're getting a little long-winded. So if you do these kind of dinner parties, you ought to appoint somebody to be the timekeeper.
Get wrapped up and may forget. The end needs to come at some point. Let me get another, if I may, George, from Hinesburg, Vermont. Rick, you're on the air with George Dawes Green.
Well, it's great to be here, and I'm really fascinated with this subject because I grew up listening to my mother spin tales from our kitchen table. She was originally from Poland, so she used to tell me all these fascinating stories about her land, and I think it lit a spark in me, and I started telling stories. I'm a musician, and started telling stories, and people started saying, well, you're a storyteller. I never really thought about being a storyteller. I thought that it was something that everyone did. And then I found out the magic that we have in storytelling. And I got a chance to work with Utah Phillips and also Pete Seeger, some of the greatest storytellers that I've ever met, and some Native American storytellers as well. There was a man here in Vermont who's no longer with us named Wolf Song, who used to tell such wonderful stories that captivated both the young and the old.
Rick, is it avocation for you now then, or is this what you do? When, for, you know, for what?
Yes.
It's your work. It's your job. Wow.
Yeah, I tell stories and I sing songs. Yeah, that's what I do. And also I have a TV show where I interview a lot of people and get their stories.
And do people ever get tired of it?
I don't think people get tired of telling stories. I mean, I think that's the magical thing about a good story, is that if you're a child, you want to hear that same story again and again and again, as many parents will testify to. I think there's something about the repetition of stories that is delightful.
Rick, I appreciate your call very much. George Dawes Green, do people find it out suddenly? You know, one night they start talking and suddenly people are listening and maybe they're rapt. In rapt attention, and they realize I'm a storyteller? Is everybody a storyteller or not, George?
Well, everybody's a storyteller. There are some people who do seem to have a magical gift for it. I think one of the things that's most important is an ability to be vulnerable, an ability to expose oneself. You know, you were just hearing Jonathan Ames, and Jonathan Ames is able to talk about his... sex urges at the age of 12. He's able to talk about really anything that comes into his mind, whether it comes to the, you know, straight to the conscious part of his mind, or it just you know, fiddles around in the unconscious. He can reach down in there and pull it up. And there is something about this great vulnerability that he's able to expose that makes him a really great storyteller. The same thing is true of Edgar Oliver. Mm-hmm. We often have celebrities who tell stories at the Moth, and some of them are very, very strong, and some of them aren't, because they want to show a good picture of themselves.
Yeah.
And so they stand up there and they tell a story about how they did something very well. And they find that the audience, although the Moth audiences are the kindest audiences in the world, but the audience falls flat and they can feel it. And then a truly great Moth raconteur will get up there and tell the story of a disaster or of his own weakness, and the audience responds uproariously. That's the really amazing thing that I think we've discovered in the 14 years of the Moth, as we've begun to understand the qualities that make a good story.
I mean, maybe that showing vulnerability is the hallmark, because it's a kind of a mark of truth. I mean, we're all vulnerable. We're all flawed. If you're not including that, you're not really opening the robe there.
That's it, exactly. There's a great quote by Nathaniel Hawthorne in The Scarlet Letter. He says, "Be true, be true, be true. Show freely to the world, if not your worst, yet some trait whereby the worst may be inferred." So I think Hawthorne knew it. Mark Twain clearly knew it when he would get up and tell his stories. He was never talking about his great successes. Mm. He was talking about what a terrible soldier he was, or how he utterly embarrassed himself before the New England Brahmins, and that's, you know, that really is the absolute key to a great story, is to say, I'm human.
I think a lot of the circumstance, I mean, a porch is great, a campfire is great, but, you know, I remember great stories from workplaces where there was time where you couldn't do anything. I used to work in Alaska, and we'd spend a lot of time just in bulldozers in the freezing way, sub-zero cold, and those bulldozer drivers, you know, they would just have up in the cab all the time in the world, and you're going to tell stories.
Yeah.
And they would be so honest about their flaws in their family life. Worked with a great dynamiter up there with a wonderful name, Eno Coppola. God bless his soul. And he would tell me stories about growing up as a shepherd in Montana and the stuff he found down in the gold mines, you know, and how he'd screw up and blow something up in the wrong way sometimes. I mean,
what was that name? Is he a
Basque? It was actually, his family was from Lapland.
Oh, my God.
And he had that, you know, those sort of apple cheeks and a cherry tobacco pipe, and would just tell those stories. But just workplaces. Not today's workplace with the cubicle and something constantly to do flashing on the screen.
Right.
But old-time workplaces where there was some downtime. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
My experience with storytelling began when I was about 5 years old, when my dad bought a small hotel, a commercial hotel, and we lived there and grew up in the living room for our family was also the hotel lobby.
Yeah.
At the time, we had a traveling salesman who could not retreat to their rooms to watch television because their rooms did not have televisions. These guys would sneak their brown bag of bourbon, sit around the lobby there, and tell stories many times from their World War II experience, because we were a few years after World War II, and they were all veterans. I love those stories. Since then, I've been to storytelling festivals, spent God knows how many hours in bars and hotel lobbies. I have never heard such rich, varied, and imaginative stories as these old guys were telling.
And there you were in the corner of the lobby, curled up and taking it all in, Mike.
That was me, 5 years old, 6 years old, seven, eight, listening to those rich and greatly exaggerated stories.
But I'm not sure I equate that with a hotel lobby today. I mean, is that still out there, Mike?
Oh, no. Hotel lobbies today, as far as I know, tend to be places where people stand around waiting to meet their business partner, or either where they check in and then they immediately run upstairs, get their room service drink, and kick back with their television sets, as far as I can tell.
What do you say,
well,
George?
Everything has become impersonal and efficient. You know, The very sad thing about the South now, where I live, is that back in the, I guess it was the 1940s, as air conditioning was sweeping the land, people stopped building porches and people stopped mm-hmm. sitting on porches. Mm-hmm. And you had your little, you know, your little backyard area and your deck where you could sit with the people that you knew. But people weren't even doing that. And these days, everybody's got a, you know, a satellite dish in front of those cold bunker-like brick houses that they're building. Mm. And people are sitting at their computers blogging about their opinions on Hillary Clinton and thinking that they are members of some kind of community, but they're not at all, which is why when we bring the moth into these communities, people come running because, you know, all of a sudden we're talking about people telling stories. And
yeah.
And it's an experience that everybody can share.
I mean, it's great that you bring that, but in a way, it's strange that it must be brought. I mean, I remember, maybe you as well, Mike, maybe you, the sort of, not a hotel lobby in my case, but the grain elevator was a great place for storytelling because farmers would show up. They'd have their trucks waiting in line outside to, you know, to dump, empty the grain, have it weighed and all that, and they'd... There'd be some soda pop, and the people sit around. And the even the physical gesture that would announce somebody was about to start a yarn, maybe they'd get a big sweep of their arm and slap their thigh, and off they'd go. Everybody knew the routine. Everybody knew there was going to be entertainment here, Mike.
And I think as well that things like farmers' co-ops now, where they come and meet and buy their corn and whatnot, that I think they tell a lot of stories there. Anecdotally, because I don't go to farmers' co-ops, but I
I feel that. Maybe you should. Mike, I appreciate your call very much. It's great to have it. Let's hear a little more from the Moth. Here's a bit from the Moth main stage performance from Cindy Chupac, writer, executive producer of the popular TV series Sex and the City, tells an interesting story at the Moth about her husband.
It was 5 days before my 10-year high school reunion when my husband told me he thought he might be gay. He wasn't sure he was gay because he had never been with a man yet, but he thought it was something he ought to figure out. Good idea. Now, I think he told me this at that moment, not to get out of my high school reunion, which would be understandable, but in order to, because we'd been looking for houses together, and we'd finally found one in Pasadena that we both liked. And I think somehow the forever of a wedding vow sounded kind of vague and idealistic to him, whereas 30-year mortgage was surprisingly specific. It was a commitment, you know, the kind of commitment you shouldn't make while your sexuality is pending.
There's Cindy Chupac from Sex and the City. Really? Is that unrehearsed, George? Is that really unrehearsed?
Well, Cindy's story will be rehearsed to the in the sense that she'll get to tell it once or twice to a director. But we're adamant that you don't try to memorize your stories. If you try to memorize it, if you've got it down word for word, it'll come out sounding mm-hmm. cold and icy. Mm-hmm. And so there really needs to be the sense when the audience is watching you that you're cooking this thing right in front of them, and that, you know, it's being baked up in the oven of your cranium.
Yeah. Right there, right now.
Right before them. And that's what makes the experience so transcendent. You know, there's this movie that a bunch of my friends are going to, and I know some of them like it, some of them don't. Inception.
Oh, yeah.
And
Put me in the don't category.
And millions of dollars on this.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they're getting the same kind of effect as you would get just going to one Moth night and just listening to a few people telling stories.
George Dawes Green, please stand by. We're talking storytelling. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Comments, George, here from Facebook. Delinda says, I was born and raised in North Africa. The stories I tell my children are endless and usually happen in the car or dinner table. I'm noticing how it's rubbing off on my kids. They're starting to enjoy elaborating on their own experiences, making up the voices and facial expressions. It's truly delightful, she writes, to see that another generation of oral storytellers is evolving right in front of my eyes. And Daniel in Somerville, Massachusetts. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi there, it's Daniel Gewirtz from Somerville, Tom.
Hi.
I have been part of a group called Mass Mouth, which patterns itself after the moth, and I just started a group called the Roving Raconteurs with a couple of guys. Been telling stories all my life in casual situations and dinner parties and, you know, going home from work, and I love doing it. I also, you know, am a writer. I feel there's enormous differences between writing a story and telling a story.
Tell us more about that. Like what, Daniel?
Well, there are fewer words involved. You can't get, you know, adjectives and mm-hmm. long-winded sentences don't exactly work unless you have a natural cadence to them that grips the listener. And also I found, and I really wanted to ask about this, I found that stories that are more dark and mysterious and talk about the essential mystery and bizarreness of life by the end of it don't go over as well as stories that have a happy ending and a resolution and a kind of affirmation of self.
You mean in the oral telling, in the storytelling, not the writing, you mean?
Specifically mm-hmm. in the storytelling on-stage experiences.
That's an interesting observation.
I tell a story where the punchline is, life is bizarre and amazing and mysterious, and I'm just a lost person in the middle of it. It doesn't quite come across as well as a story that you know, ends up with, and this is where I realized that life was beautiful and I was a big part of it.
Let us pick it up. Daniel, I appreciate your call. George, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. I find that very interesting. I think in New York, we like a little darker story. But it is true that stories almost invariably have to be funny. They should be funny, at least in part. But we have a lot of stories that are actually very tragic, and they work extremely well. I mean, it's just it has to be a great storyteller. It has to be an audience that's really ready for this. And you know, it's interesting, even when you go from borough to borough in New York, because mm-hmm. we have a moth slam that we do in Brooklyn, and those stories because they're generally college kids, and those stories are kind of raucous and wild, and a lot of jokes about flatulence, and they can also be, you know, extremely profound. But there is a different audience and a different feel. But then you go to the main stage, moth, and folks are looking for, you know, more complex, tenderer moments. So what I think is going on, mm-hmm. And I find this fascinating that your caller is one of these folks who's working with, you know, one of the groups that have sort of sprung up in our wake. And there are groups all over the world now that are, you know, I like to think of them as my grandchildren. And what we're seeing now is the evolution, the very rapid evolution of this art form, which I think is going to be the art form of the 21st century, the art of raconteuring, the art of telling personal, unscripted stories.
Really? It's going to fight back the tweet and the Hollywood blockbuster and everything
absolutely,
in between?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I think those guys are doomed. I mean, you need to just come to a few moth nights, and you'll see people become, they become overwhelmed. Why the reason the moth is so powerful is because it's not just going out for a night where art is going to be thrown in your face. It's a night of community. People come and listen to the stories and then stay and keep drinking and keep telling more stories. And people are hungry for real communities.
Let's get a call from Morrisville, Vermont, and Hank. Hank, you're on the air with George Dawes Green.
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I own a bike shop in here in Morrisville, and it is the most amazing place for stories that come out of people's mouths in this place.
While they're standing around waiting for their wheel to be fixed, maybe.
Yeah, whether that, but it's a great way to break the social barrier, you know, if it's hard to communicate. People like to make up stories, you know, come up with a story, and it helps break the barrier of communications. So if people are uncomfortable.
And is everybody willing to listen, Hank, or are some people like looking the other way and going out to sit in their car to escape?
Oh, everybody listens, you know. And that's the thing. It's the one story he's told, and someone has a similar story of, you know, like say someone gets hurt or something, and you know, so then someone reminds them of a story of how they got hurt, and it just keeps conversation going. It's just it's an amazing thing. I think that's what a lot of conversation is storytelling.
Yeah, no question about it. Hank, thanks for your call.
Well, I love hearing that. That's just very moving. It's great when I hear about teachers who are telling their students, go home and think about a story about your own life. Has to be a true story out of your own personal experience, and bring it into class, and we'll give you 5 minutes to tell the story. And the kids are just energized. And it's such a way, as Mike pointed out, it's such a way for people to get to know each other.
Jan in Virginia Beach. Virginia, Jan, you're on the air.
Thank you. Mine's more of a grandmother story. When my granddaughter was about 5, 4, 5, 6, when I tuck her in at night, I would tell her a story that wound what we did during the day, but it was all about the princess and the princess who was rescued by her Jack Russell dog, which she had a Jack Russell dog, and it was always fanciful and filled with glitter and stars and everything that little girls want to hear.
Right.
Well, at one point in Norfolk, we had mermaids that were put out that had all different patterns, and I took her all around Norfolk because she lives on the Outer Banks in North Carolina. We went all around Norfolk and took pictures of her with the mermaids, and then I put the mermaid pictures together in a little book with a story about the princess, and I also took pictures of my neighbors and friends that she knew, and my neighbor across the street is Barbara, and she used to call her Babawa, so she was the good queen Babawa who lived across the street. Well, time goes on. About a year or so ago, and she was like 11 at the time.
Yo.
She said, I just showed my book, my mermaid book, to my friend Tori, and she thinks it's the most amazing thing she ever saw, and she loves it.
So she went on to write up the stories that you had shared with her as grandmother, and they're coming back.
Well, I actually put together the mermaid book, and it held up. And she still knew the people and knew the mermaids and then showed it to her friend.
So who got more out of it, Jan, you or your granddaughter? She probably loved the tales you were weaving through everything around, but it sounds like you had a pretty good time yourself.
Oh, I love doing the mermaid book. And now she's older and she doesn't want to hear stories. And it's like, oh, no, but she still got the mermaid book.
Jan, I appreciate your call. Thank you very much for calling. You know, George, you as you said, you've got a lot of celebrities who do this and then those who aren't. I mean, you've had... What, the comedian Louis Black and the Andy Borowitz and Terry Garr, Ethan Hawke, and Garrison Keillor, and tons of Salman Rushdie, for heaven's sake, Gay Talese, for heaven's sakes. Is there a difference between, I mean, you were saying earlier, maybe some of the celebrities don't show as much vulnerability, but can you tell who's a pro and who's not when they hit the stage? And which is there a better or worse? Who comes up with the better tale?
Well, there are some who are just... magnificent. I really think Garrison Keillor is the great raconteur of our time. Mm-hmm. And he loves to do The Moth because he can tell stories that he can't tell on Prairie Home Companion. Mm-hmm. They can be, you know, somewhat scatological. And the other thing he said, the thing that originally turned him on about The Moth is somebody played a tape of a moth evening, and he was listening to the audience response, and people were hooting and hollering at the stories because we have such energized audiences. And he said, you know, in Minnesota, people don't hoot and holler at stories.
You've got him. You've got him nailed. Right there.
But they do. But, you know, they do at The Moth, and he loves that freedom. And so he's one of those celebrities who will come out and reveal himself. George Plimpton, the late, great George Plimpton, was an amazing brilliant storyteller, Frank McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes, sure. could tell us, you know, in that gorgeous Irish lilt, could tell us the saddest stories that you've ever heard,
yeah.
and manage to keep them light and flowing. So it's not that we don't have a lot of brilliant celebrities. We just every now and then have a celebrity who has been told all his life by all the people around him mm-hmm. that he's a great storyteller.
Mm.
And so doesn't realize until he's on the Moth stage that he isn't a great storyteller and then he has nothing to tell except stories of his successes. And we actually have had celebrities who've gotten off the stage and have come up to the director and said, "I'm sorry, can I do it again?"
Oh, boy.
And they will, and they'll, you yeah. know, and the next time they'll be great.
Maybe a little more honest, a little more vulnerable.
A little more honest, exactly. That's what they learn.
I've read you saying that as a storyteller, a Moth storyteller, you said all your flaws and fakeries, awkwardness or slickness, are instantly visible on stage. What happens there? How?
Well, there's also that fact, you know, that actors love to go up on stage and present many different selves, because that's what they're trained to do. Mm-hmm. But when you go onto the Moth stage, Anna Schulite, one of our great Moth storytellers and artist, and a MacArthur Award winner, and just brilliantly insightful, once was describing one of our great storytellers and said he only brings one self up there with him. And
was that
and
a
that
compliment?
Was the key. Mm-hmm. Yeah, an mm-hmm. absolute compliment, because he wasn't trying to be anything other than who he really is.
Let's go to Winston in Nashville, Tennessee. Winston, you're on the air.
Hey, I grew up living in East Africa and in a small town in Louisiana and visiting family in the panhandle of Texas.
Right.
And the thing I remember most about... one thing I really enjoy about the stories is the shared experiences of the listeners. So the things that are left unsaid, or the things that allude to something, a comment that alludes to something that people know about, or the pauses, or...
the moment where you just roll your eyes, maybe, and everybody knows what it is.
Right, or say there's a person in town who has a reputation for being... thinking highly of themselves, yeah. but they're in an embarrassing situation, and the little smile at the corner of the mouth, or
is all it takes.
Like that.
Yeah, the little gesture.
Right, and so I think the nonverbal part of storytelling is something that's so important, that the pause or the gesture or the smile or the frown or that gets lost when you're dealing with mass media.
Yeah.
So the close personal connections between among the storyteller and all the people listening.
Lost unless you're there. And if it's a community, you can sort of tweak people just with a cocked eyebrow for sure, Winston. George, what do you say?
No, absolutely. It's the silences that make the stories work. And the other thing that's so amazing is that so much of the story is visible to the audience the moment the storyteller stands up there. We had a storyteller who was, you know, who told a brilliant story. She's a black woman from the middle class, I think from Indiana, and she had gone down to Atlanta and somehow managed to, she was working in a home health care environment, and she was assigned to work at this old gentleman's house, and turned out that he was a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan,
oh,
and he was dying, and she was taking care of him.
Wow.
And it's a brilliant, moving story, the moment when she realizes that white gown that she has been fascinated by, because the stitching is so beautiful and all the gold embroidery, that then she realizes, wait, that's a Klansman's gown, and I am in the middle of, you know, of the enemy encampment. But what was interesting was that the first time she told the story, she took 3 or 4 minutes to explain to us her background,
mm-hmm.
and that she was a black woman from the middle class. Well, the audience knew that the moment she opened her mouth. And after that, I think she realized she didn't need to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And our great storytellers are so aware of the things that they don't need to say, the things that are just simply going to carry because of their presence. And as your listener points out, it's those amazing silences that seal the deal, that make stories transform from ordinary narratives into something that sweeps us away.
Just to be there, vulnerable and ready to share humanity, ready to share a story. What a wonderful conversation. It's really great to share it with you. George Dawes Green, novelist, author of The Juror, The Caveman's Valentine, and just out in paperback, Ravens, founder of The Moth, joining us today from Savannah, Georgia. George, it's been wonderful having you with us. Thank you so much. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And tell stories. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.